This is Steve Maxter conducting an interview with Mr. Richard Gomez on the 8th of July, the year 2000, at approximately 2:30 in the afternoon in Savannah, Georgia. Mr. Gomez, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Well, my name is Richard Gomez. I was born October 9, 1947, in Brownsville, Texas. I grew up in South Padre Island and Brownsville, Texas.
Okay. What year did you graduate from high school?
I graduated from high school in 1966, mm-hmm. and I joined the Army in September 17, 1964 through the National Guard.
Okay. What made you decide to go into the National Guard?
As I was growing up, all my uncles had served in the military, so they, as the elders, they felt that I should join too, so they got me into the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts. And then when I reached that level, I didn't want to be in the Boy Scouts anymore, and I started looking at the National Guard. And my uncles had friends that were in the National Guard, so I joined the National Guard because my whole interest was to eventually join the Army, because it was a family tradition to have the eldest always serve in the military.
Okay. What was it like going into the National Guard, or into the Army recruiting office, finding out about going into the military, and especially?
Before I joined the National Guard, I went to investigate the U.S. Army recruiting office and see what they have to say, and basically I walked up to a Sergeant First Class Salazar, who was the NCO recruiter for the United States Army, and I asked him that I wanted to join the Airborne Rangers that I heard of, and he basically fell off his chair and said, "You want to join the Airborne Rangers? How old are you, boy?" And I said, 16, and he says, "But you're a stick, and you're so little." Well, I was 5'9", 130 pounds. But he didn't know I was a cross-country runner and that I always wanted to join the military, so I already had, I thought, the mental attitude for it. And he asked me, he says, "Why the Airborne Rangers?" And I said, "Well, I want to be with the best," which I thought were the very best.
Okay. So you decided...
Well, I talked to him about joining, and he basically said that I was didn't look... that I had enough muscle in my body or big enough, because like I said, I was 5'9", 130 pounds, mm-hmm. skinny little boy, mm-hmm. 16 years old, and he didn't think so. Anyway, we've talked for a little while, he gave me some information, I left, and I went and talked to some friends that were in the National Guard, friends of my uncle's, and I went and said, "Well, okay, I'll join the National Guard," and they basically said, "Well, come, why don't you come over when we have drill on the weekend and introduce yourself to the captain there and see what we can do. Maybe, you know, you can help us in the kitchen, in the mess hall." Yeah. And so I say, fine, I went.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you went into the National Guard in 64.
Right.
When did you go to basic training?
I went in basic training. I don't remember exactly when I went in basic training, but it wasn't too long after that, because I went through... I went through the summer, mm-hmm. and a little part into the first, into the September, which was when I was supposed to report for high school, mm-hmm. and I didn't, so I didn't start the next coming semester. But I would have graduated with 23 and a half credits, mm-hmm. and I only needed 18. Okay. So by not being there to finish that one semester of school, I graduated the coming semester with 18 and a half. So I still had enough to graduate. And that's when I went to boot camp, AIT, at Fort Polk, Louisiana.
What was that like?
Fort Polk, Louisiana? Well, that was, to me, was my uncles and my father had raised me what I thought was a common way that kids are raised. So when I was there, they told me, and my guard friends also told me, when you get there, always tell the drill instructor, "Thank you, drill instructor." and they were like playing with me because I didn't know that, you know. So when I was there and I walk out of the bus and they're yelling at me and they tell me to do push-ups, as soon as I would stand up, I would go, "Thank you, drill sergeant," and it only make them angrier.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then I thought, well, maybe that's just the way they are. So I kept telling them, "Thank you, drill sergeant." And when I graduated from boot camp, they came up to me and I,
"Oh,
you're finally a graduate of boot camp," and I said, "Thank you, drill sergeant." "When the hell are you ever going to stop telling me that? You know how many push-ups you're going to get for?" And I said, "I never really thought about it. I thought that was how you guys were. You just give us push-ups, no damn reason." You know. So during boot camp, because of the way I was raised, when I was going through boot camp, I kept thinking, well, when is this going to get harder? Because my uncles and my dad were a whole lot harder to me. So that time I went to boot camp, I was always waiting. I went, and I would ask the drill instructor when he would ask anybody have any questions, I consider now thinking back that I was a smart ass, because I would go, "Drill instructor, when is it going to get harder?" And I remembered him throwing we had M1 Garretts, and we were just about to receive the M14s. And he threw the M1 Garrett at me and said, "Run around the building all night." So while everybody was sleeping here at 11 o'clock at night, 2,300 hours, I was running around the barracks. And this is the old barrack,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you put like 43 soldiers downstairs and upstairs, running around all night long, yelling, "I am an airborne ranger, I am an airborne ranger," all night long. And then they woke us up at 4 o'clock in the morning, but I'm still out there running, and I had to pull the whole day. And then he came back and asked me again, and he says, and this was, I never forgot his name, this is Drill Instructor Lion, short little guy, his face looked like a lion, you know, with yellow eyes. I thought he was like a demon to me, you know, like, "Oh my God, you know, Drill Instructor Lyons." And he came up to me and he goes, "Was that hard enough for you?" And I gave him a mouth shot this time, because I thought I'd get into trouble anyway, but I still got push-ups for not saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I think about it, I said, well, okay, you know, they kept me up that one night, but when is it going to really get hard? Because my uncles and my dad have put this picture. That it was going to get so hard, that it was going to drop me to my knees and make me cry. And I was going, well, that hasn't happened yet. And he said, they're going to run you to death until you break. But then I was a cross-country runner, so I kept thinking, well, you know, we run 5 miles in the morning and five in the evening, but when is it going to get harder? Well, thinking back, the only time it got harder was when I wound up in Vietnam. And all that training and what my uncles taught me and my dad and the guardsmen taught me and boot camp and AIT and what I learned in Korea, I was very thankful to all those drill instructors that taught me, because I used everything to keep alive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When did you go to infantry AIT?
Well, right after boot camp, we had a 14-day leave. And then I attended advanced infantry training, also in Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Fort Polk. Mm-hmm. And what was the biggest difference between your infantry training, AIT, and basic?
Advanced infantry training dealt with learning about weapons. You were already done with the development of the body, which they do in boot camp. Mm-hmm. They run you through the discipline of wearing the uniform as a soldier, all the basic disciplines that you would get to becoming a soldier. Now that you've become a soldier, in advanced infantry training, they taught you how to handle radios, 45 calibers, M14s, M60s, 50 calibers, 80 millimeter heavy weapons, the law, APCs, all the different weapons and equipment that you would run into in a regular TONE outfit.
Okay. What about land navigation and patrolling?
Land navigation and patrolling also, yes. Mm-hmm. That we had always. in boot camp as well as in AIT, continuously. That was all part of the training, weapons training and land navigation and field training of all types, bivouacs of all types. So,
okay. Mm-hmm. How did they enforce discipline generally in both schools? I mean, you mentioned how they dealt with you in particular with push-ups and running around the barracks that one night. Mm-hmm. What about other soldiers? Were there ever any problems with people that you were aware of? You know, other soldiers that went too far in their disrespect or?
Well, basically, if you were asked to pick up your rifle and you called it a gun, they would stand you on top of the second story balcony in your shorts, in your underwear, and with your right hand you would have your rifle and you would say, "This is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for killing, this is for fun." And you do that all day long. And they make you grab yourself between your legs and say, "And this is for fun. This is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for killing, this is for fun." And you do that all day long, and then they tell the troops not to laugh. "You will not laugh at this man." Well, what's the first thing you're going to do?
Oh, yeah, you break
up. Right? So everybody, push-ups, and more push-ups, and more running. Incidentally, when I went into boot camp, even though it was Fort Polk, we were an airborne boot camp, which means we ran all the time. We ran everywhere. We didn't walk anywhere. And when we went to the mess hall, we stood in parade rest. We went to horizontal bar and did push-ups before we went in to eat. We had 5 minutes to eat or less. Out, you get out, you take a break, then you go back into training and you run everywhere. When I went to advanced infantry training, we ran, it was also airborne, AIT. We ran everywhere, did push-ups for everything, horizontal bars for everything, obstacle course. We ran in the morning, we ran in the evening, and we ran from 2,300 hours to 0,400 was sleep time. Mm-hmm. Right? And we basically all dreaded KP. And someone would come over and tie a white towel on your bed, and you knew you had KP. Okay. I got out of hand in boot camp, and they, for telling the drill sergeant, "Thank you, drill sergeant," too many times, and he put me in, and as a KP for 3 straight days, and peeling potatoes, and I had to wash the pots and pans, and peeling potatoes, and pots and pans, and peeling potatoes. So, I forgot not to stop saying that, and I continued saying that, and I kept. So they took me to the PT field, and the drill instructor told me to run until he got tired. Now they don't get tired. So I started running, but then we ran with uniform, the regular fatigue uniform and combat boots, but without the shirt on, with the t-shirt on, and that was it. And I started running, but he didn't know that I had been a cross-country runner. So I take off running slow for an 8-minute mile, and so I kept on running and running and running and running. He had me out there running 16 to 20 laps, round and round and round and round. And he kept noticing that the further I ran, the faster I got. So he just stopped me, dropped me down to a push-up position and asked me and said, "Why didn't you tell me you were a runner?" And I said, "Drill Sergeant, you didn't ask me." You know. So I got into trouble for that. You know. So it was basically like that. I kept getting into trouble, but I realized that the more that they got me to do push-ups, because I was a runner, I had a weak top. And the push-ups developed the top side of me, because my legs were already developed. I ran all the time. I ran at home. I lived in a gangster area, gang area. So I ran to school since I was in elementary. and the dogs chased me, so I ran even faster than that. And I had to cross this huge field that had Brahma bulls. And it was a dry riverbed, and it had black snakes. And we had to pass by there early in the morning before the sun comes up to go to school, to junior high school. And I had to run through there because the Brahma bulls would chase us. Mm-hmm. But it was a shortcut. And they told us, don't take that area because the bulls will charge you. Mm-hmm. But me, it was a challenge. It's where I practiced my running and jumping over snakes. And because it had tall grass, elephant grass, and cut through there and jump over the snakes and sidetrack the Brahma bulls and get across. And I was already, as soon as I got on the other side of the fence, there was my junior high school. So getting back to that, that's how I began to develop my legs. So my legs were basically always well developed. And so when I got into school, I got into track and field. It was very easy to get into track as a cross-country runner. And one of the things that happened that I can remember.
Any physical altercations between drill sergeants and the trainees? Did anybody ever have to be taken around the back of the barn, so to speak, to be put in their place?
No. They had such a controlled from the moment that you get off of that, the bus, so well controlled that you did exactly what they told you to do, and there was no one that I remember. Even though at the time there was this constant racial thing, never anyone that, I mean, they got up to your face. It was back then where they could hit you. Okay. And they got up right up to your face and said, you want to take me on right in front of the troops, right here, right now. And nobody would do that. Mm-hmm. We had one guy that was a black belt. And he swung. This was not a fight. This was where he just got tired and swung at the drill instructor. But the drill instructor forgot to tell us that he was also a black belt and got him down immediately. Plus, we had learned in the military. And that soldier was very obedient from that time on. Wouldn't use his. He didn't know this other guy was also. But they were basically like that. They were very disciplined. And they instilled that discipline in us. And so I really liked that part of it. It was, you couldn't scratch your nose without asking for permission, or less call one of the other troops in the back and get into a fight. Because when you were told to go in the barracks, to go here and go there, everybody went to where they were supposed to be, and then they were checked to make sure they had a head count, to make sure everybody was where they were supposed to be at all times. Because they know that when you go to boot camp, whoever doesn't like it is going to try to go AWOL.
Yeah.
So they're always checking on that.
Right.
And AIT was even easier. AIT was easier compared to any boot camp. Because in AIT, there was it was more classroom, a lot of field, but a lot of classroom studies, learning all the different weapons.
Was there anything in particular that was important for you to take away from that training that you used later in Korea, or more importantly in Vietnam?
Everything. The more important thing that I learned was where they taught us, where they set us out in the sun in bleachers to give us a class. After being awake almost all night, sitting us out there in the sun, and this year making me remember things now, right up and down the bleachers. And you could not fall asleep. You had to stay awake. You do systematic search, and you had to stay awake. And the guys that were falling asleep, he would tell us that. He would say, you fall asleep, and you fall asleep on duty, you will die. And everything was so serious. I mean, the idea of just, well, I'm going to take a 2-minute nap. No way. You couldn't. You could not close your eyes. You would get into such serious trouble. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have to hit you.
Excuse me. Okay, go ahead.
There was always a psychological threat that they were going to beat you and run their fist into your chest and hand you your heart before you died. So being they were like very suggestible kids at the age of 17 and 18, we believed everything they told us. We thought they were Superman. And thinking back, they were very well trained, very well disciplined. The duty they put you to do was the part where if you had to be disciplined, it was worse, the duty they put you to do, that the guys would say to them, we would talk among ourselves, if they only beat me, I know that'll be over in minutes. But they put you to duty for days on end. They put you to be a KP. They run you all night, like they did with me around the barracks with my rifle, with port arms, running. And do you think it's hard now? And I hesitated, and that even put me to do even more push-ups. The other one was when we were on the bleachers. They would give us a break, and I happened to put my right hand, I remember, because you had to sit at attention. You know, your back straight, stomach in, chest out, like this, listening to the class. At all times, you couldn't slouch, right? And sitting there like that, you get tired. So when I got off the bleachers for a break, I put my hand on my hip. Okay? Wrong. Right? What do you think you are, a ballerina? One guy put his hand on a tree.
Oh boy.
Right? You think it's dead, the tree's going to fall down, you're trying to hold it up. Another guy had been caught sleeping. Actually, all he did was just close his eyes a little bit. You cannot close your eyes longer than 1 second, okay, or you're caught sleeping. So here we are, they had me running around the bleachers while they're giving this serious class. And I'm skipping, saying, with both hands on my hips, saying, I am a ballerina. I am a ballerina. I love being a ballerina.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, and then they told the troops, they were sitting on the bleachers, you cannot laugh. Pay complete attention to what we're teaching you. The other guy that was falling asleep was on the ground doing the dead cockroach. You ever seen that? Put you on the ground and flailing around in the leg, but this is, I'm a dying cockroach, I'm a dying cockroach. The other guy was yelling at the tree, please tree, don't fall, I'll hold you up. Please tree, don't fall, I'll hold you up. All this is going on while they're giving this class, and of course I'm like totally embarrassed. This is my beginning of, I'm going to kill this drill instructors when I, you know, when I get out of this. Right, this is too damn embarrassing. I'm a soldier. Yeah. Right. But that was the last time they caught me. They caught me touching my hips. You know. So, and it was even worse if you stuck your hands in your pocket. You think you're playing bitter ball? Get it, boy. You will never stick your hands in your pocket ever again for as long as you sleep. You understand that? And then we were getting very well trained like this. And of course, you don't understand, this is airborne AIT, so they expect everybody to go to airborne school. And we went to bivouacking. We're all in formation. And how I found out that I should be in a special ops unit was I was standing in attention out there among the trees. And the bees were all over the place, and they came over, and one got on my finger and sting me. So my finger begins to swell, and I'm at attention, so I don't say anything. You know, push-ups, right? Climb up a tree, ballerina. I said, I had learned my lesson. I don't tell this guy anything. You know, I'm supposed to stand there in attention and take the sting. So I finished taking the sting. He falls out of formation. Anybody have any questions, you come over and talk to me. So I just kind of up to him like this. And he says, what do you want? And I show him my hand, and I still got the stinger on there. I had to leave the stinger because I didn't want him to think I was making it up. And I show him the stinger like this, and he says, well, I got stung by a bee. And it was already all swelled up like that. And he goes, damn! You got a strong constitution, boy. Maybe you ought to be in special ops. That's when I begin to hear about special ops. So I ask him, what is special ops? Maybe you ought to be in recon. Well, what does recon do? And this is exactly where I begin to pick up, yes, this is the kind of thing I want to be in. Maybe. First I got to find out what it is. So they sent me in there, got it cured, and I came back, and he was like, impressed that I had stood attention and taken the sting of a bee without even making a sound. And I said, they're looking for guys like you that can get stung like this and not make a sound. And that's where I got to be introduced in AIT to what reconnaissance. So he told me, put his hand around my shoulder, which I thought was kind of odd because this is the drill instructor that likes killing people, you know. And so he's putting his arm and he says, you know, we're going to have a cast in reconnaissance. Don't you listen real carefully to this, see if you like that. Because we can assign you to a unit to be recon. You got the right material. If you don't yell and made a sound when you got a bee sting, then you're the right material, because they're always looking for guys that don't make any noise when that kind of stuff happens. So I said, fine. And then he came up to me and asked me, he says, you ever heard of Korea? And that's how I got assigned. And I said, no. And I said, is it in the Orient? Because I wanted to go to the Orient. And he said, yes, it's in the Orient. It's in the Far East. That's why I learned about the Far East. Because, you know, I'm a kid, and I don't know anything about that. And Far East, and I said, is it close to Vietnam? And he says, yeah, as a matter of fact, but you don't want to go there just yet. Let's see, maybe we can send you to Korea. I said, but I want to get other kinds of training. We'll see about getting you some training when you get there instead of here. And when I finished AIT is when I got orders to be assigned to Korea. And when I got to Korea and got to replacement company and sent to the 2nd Infantry Division, they assigned me directly to the Indian Scouts, which was their division reconnaissance line. The LARPs are for the 1st Infantry Division that I was in Vietnam. And they sent me to training. They sent me to their academy, a type of advanced infantry academy that they have for reconnaissance personnel. And reconnaissance personnel and NCOs. So here I was as a PFC already going through that kind of a training. And it was very good. It was a lot of psychological warfare training and all that that dealt with to be able to face the North Koreans, because for some reason when I went to Outpost Santa Barbara on the DMZ, all I heard from the other side, from the three-story speakers I had on the other side, was my name. Welcome to Korea. And I'm going like, how the heck did they get my name? I got this cold chill down my back. And the guy says to me, my sergeant says to me, I was a newbie, right? Grabs me and says to me, says, don't worry, we'll send you a trainer how to handle this. They play excellent music in Christmas time. You'll have a lot of fun up here, you'll see. They think that they're breaking you down, but man, when you hear the music, you'll love it. You'll send them a thank you letter, you know. And of course, I couldn't believe them. I said, no, I'm totally scared. See, I grew up scared of Orientals when I was little. I couldn't be around Orientals because the scary made me cry. So that's why I had asked to go to the Orient, because I wanted to defeat this fear. Can I continue with the Korean?
Oh, absolutely, please.
Okay. When I landed in Korea, just to go back, when I landed in Kimpo Air Force Base in Korea, in the sensor replacement company, in the bus going to the 2nd Infantry Division, we were fired at by North Korean infiltrators. So I thought, I hear this ding, 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 hitting the bus, and I don't think anything of it. I mean, I've been through training. Boot camp, AIT, my drill sergeant didn't like me, so he would, when we were doing the targets out in the field, he would send us out in the field so that we'd be moving the targets and then dashing down under when the bullets would hit. And he would tell us, he'd call us up, and he'd go, you people in the field, stand next to your targets until I tell you to. Right? And right in the moment, he would say, commence, fine! And right before you hear this, it says,
get in the hole! And we'd jump in, and you'd see bullets fly all over the place. And we're going like, I thought that was normal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No, he was sending all the soldiers hitting luck to the target. So anyway, back to Korea. It sounded like bullets hitting the bus, but I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. I'm petrified. I'm completely surrounded by Orientals. The smell is bad. It's a different world. I recognize nothing like the States. Nothing is the same. Everything smells bad. Get to the unit and get assigned to the 2nd Infantry Division, and I'm petrified. I'm going, and then the first thing they do when I get assigned there, they hand me my gear and they said, in 1 hour, you're going to the DMZ. You're getting a tour.
Well.
And I said, and when are we coming back? He says, in 15 days. So I wind up in the DMZ with all the gear. And the outpost, center of the outpost, is you climb up to this outpost because it's on a hill. And it's got all this fortification around like that. And it's got a trench line going around. And a hump in the center, and a little house over here where the guy slept. And that way is North Korea. And you look down, and there's a little sign like this says, DMZ. And it says, don't ever walk there, because the snipers from the other side will shoot you. And we have scopes here, like this, mm-hmm. from the trench line, to look across, because they snipe you. You see? Meaning that you get a bullet between the eyes, and you're dead. Mm-hmm. That's it. No, they were teaching us all that. So I was completely petrified when the North Koreans decided to attack. A small raider unit came across, and we finally started looking over the top to fire, and I'm like this, and I'm watching them coming across, and I think I'm watching a movie. It was a moment of baptism of fire, mm-hmm. my very first one. So I was glad that it was in Korea and not in Vietnam, because at least I had all these other soldiers around me going like, grabbing from behind, get him down, he's frozen. You know, get up there and start shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Like this. And I'm like, and he turns around, gets down, looks at me, and he goes, get up there and fire that weapon. And I'm shaking, mm-hmm. and I'm doing the jitterbug, you know, because I mean, like, my whole body's shaking, and I'm going like, stop that, you know, be the soldier you're supposed to be, you always wanted to do this. So I climb up there, and I start firing. And I begin to get my baptism of fire, you know, actually shooting an actual enemy that was actually trying to kill me. And I went to the deepest realization in my mind, oh my God, somebody who I don't even know really, really wants to kill me. And I haven't done a thing to him. I mean, it wasn't as bad as the gangs, because the gangs would beat you,
mm-hmm.
stab you, but you kind of like lived, you know? Cut you, all that stuff, but you lived. Yeah. Over here it was like, they're really trying to kill you,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. It was my biggest realization of my life. And I was like, this cold sweat coming down, going like, so this is how it's like. And then I was, had tears coming down my eyes, and I didn't know why. And I was laughing at the same time. So it was all this crisscross of emotions, laughter, crying, get up here with my sergeant going, Gama, stop that shit and get up here. And I go like, and I still don't understand the lingo, so I'm going, stop what? Look at them, start shooting. You know, so I start shooting, right? Now I'm getting the hang of it, and the fighting stops, and I'm still out there pointing, shooting a little bit and dodging all this, and the sergeant comes down from the back, all right, it's done, it's over. What the hell are you shooting at now? Turn around. I'm still shaking and looking at him going, I think I could get into this. You know? Yeah. When the enemy's here, you froze. When the enemy left, you started shooting. No wonder you like it. I'll do better next time. And that was my very first. I was involved in a movie kind of shooting, because it was like I didn't get the realization, you know, that I was in it.
What weapon did they issue you? What were you firing?
In Korea, it was the
M14.
It was
the M14. Okay.
The M14, and they had some guys there with ART2s, they call them. And don't ask me what ART2 stands for anymore because I don't remember, but there were sniper rifles. They had scopes on them.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And I think it was automatic, auto. I don't remember, but it's ART stands for the scope that's on the
mm-hmm.
on the M14. And I got very interested in that. I said, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And on that first tour, I used to take trips down to Seoul. And that's where I ran into the 8th Army drill, rifle drill, shooting team or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, I said, how do you get into this? And he says, well, you got to go training. Okay, now would it be a... No, he says, have you gone to train in Okinawa? Usually we get guys that went to train in Okinawa because they're excellent shots, and that's what we need here. And I said, no, how do you volunteer for that? So I met a Sergeant Woodard that was assigned in the 8th Army headquarters, and I said, how can I do that? And he says, well, go to headquarters, 2nd Infantry Division, and apply for this, but go through your unit. Mm-hmm. To do it. I can't do it here for you. But he gave me the procedure how to do it, so I went back to my unit and talked to... Since I was just a PFC, I had my assistant team leader, and squad leader, before I even get to the platoon sergeant, the first sergeant, that I wanted to do this. So it was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would go, no, you don't need that. You're fine right where you are.
Mm-hmm.
You got a house girl, house boy cleaning up your place. What do you need? Where do you need to go? Learn this stuff for. You know, we're short manned up here. We do this, then they'll probably take you out of the unit. But eventually, the first sergeant had something out that anyone who wanted to qualify for this could qualify.
Mm-hmm.
And when I said I wanted to qualify for ART2 training, they sent me to red eye training. Which is missiles. So I came back and I said, that's not ART training. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, wait a minute. I said, ART2, this one here. Oh, that one. Well, you have to know people in Seoul, in the shooting team, or someone down at headquarters to be able to get assigned to this because they're the ones that process your paperwork. After it goes through all the channels, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I know Sergeant Woodard down at 8th Army headquarters. And I know, I don't remember the name of the sergeant, and there was one of the assistant NCOs in the rifle team,
mm-hmm.
and so for 8th Army. And I told him, I said, well, you know them? Well, sure, well, look, well, I'll put your name on here and see if you get it. So I eventually got it, and I got sent down to Seoul, and from Seoul, I think the 77th Special Forces Group was there. Had an office there. Anyway, the first Special Forces Group was in Okinawa, and that's where they send me. I can continue that, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Was in Okinawa, and they sent me there to train for what I know now as sniper training.
Mm-hmm.
And since I hadn't been airborne, and I wanted to be in a special operations unit, I said, well, look, we sometimes have to parachute you in, so you're going to go through our first Special Forces airborne training.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine, okay. So they sent me through that training there, and through sniper training, more LANAV, more training because of the snipers.
Mm-hmm.
Working as a sniper and the observer, you have to know your land navigation and your compass and maps very, very well, besides a bunch of other things that go within the scope of being a sniper, the development of a sniper. And they put you through all this conscientious type training to be able to know if you will take the shot when you need to take the shot. Well, I was crazy, you know. So anything for this, you know, I'm a warrior, I'm a soldier, hell, I'll do it. You know, so come from a bad neighborhood, I grew up that way, you know, I said, sure, I'll do it, you know. Kind of what I call nowadays, you know, a wild hair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I will go through all that training. They reassign me back to my unit, I'm part of the Injun Scouts. Now they're sending me into North Korea, see, with a recon unit. Mm-hmm. And they would come to my recon unit and pick special guys from the unit to go into the DMZ and go across the DMZ. Now, we weren't a part of the first Special Forces or anything like that, if they did that kind of work or not. Mm-hmm. But we would go across mainly to harass, not very deep, to harass the North Koreans because they harassed us. One of the ways that it was is the North Koreans used to come across to the outpost, mm-hmm. and behind the outpost, which is the South Korean side, we would receive big containers of chocolate milk, mm-hmm. right, and white milk, and we'd stick it in the snow. Well, the North Koreans would sneak around and steal our milk. Right? This is part of what we were doing, you know. So they come over and they steal our milk. We go out there, what the hell is this milk? No, you drank it. No. And then we'd find a marker in there, the unit that stole it. He says, well, what is this doing down here, Sarge? Something about, written in English, kind of funny, because they write kind of funny when they write in English. Is it something about a North Korean? Look at this. And he goes, son of a bitch, they stole our milk. So then, being that and this happened to the regular infantry, mm-hmm. being that we were there, their recon, we said, well, fine, we'll go across and steal theirs, you know. So that was the thing that was going on, plus actually pulling tactical missions and mm-hmm. finding that intelligence and all that. It came to a time when it was peaceful that the American units would come into the edge where it says DMZ, and they would come to the edge and we'd trade cigarettes and stuff with the North Korean soldiers. Hmm. And it wasn't hostile. But every once in a while we'd get really hostile and we'd be actually shooting at these same guys. Mm-hmm. See. So it went back and forth. Like, I don't have deep details. I mean, here I am, a PFC, and I have details only on the missions, but not necessarily why we did the missions. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did go across, like I did on my second tour there in Korea, and blow up the speakers mm-hmm. just to harass them. Shoot at them because their sniper was shooting at us.
Just say, what about pot shots? Like you said,
yeah.
If you put your head up, if you were in a parapet or a fighting position and your head was exposed, snipers might take shots at you. Did you guys do the same thing to them?
Yes.
So as a sniper?
Right. All the ART-2 guys, mm-hmm. some of the infantry guys would try, but that was sort of like against regulations to start an international incident. But a lot of the ART-2 guys did. When they would fire, mm-hmm. they would be prepared to fire back, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be one of those guys. They had from officers down to NCOs to enlisted that was doing that. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do it, not only because of that, but I really liked the rifle team in Seoul.
Yeah.
And I eventually wanted to join it because I was an expert shot in all the weapons. And so I wanted to do that.
Were there ever any actual kills as a result of that activity that you know?
Not that I remember in my first tour. In my second tour, there was.
Where Americans were able to kill Koreans?
Oh, yeah. No, the first tour, yes. And also on the second tour. As a matter of fact, that's how I got my second CIB. My combat infantry badge was mm-hmm. from Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And
Well, why don't you describe the incidents that occurred in your first tour, where either Koreans or Americans were killed?
Well, I don't remember Americans getting killed, but I remember North Koreans getting shot and Americans getting wounded mm-hmm. from the action mm-hmm. as they came across. And then we had heard that in Panmunjom mm-hmm. that troops friendly to us or other Americans had walked up to the North Korean side and North Koreans had chopped them up with their machetes. Yeah, so we figured, okay, you know, we're back into hassle again mm-hmm. because this is only a truce. And they had no weapons on them, so we basically figured, okay, you know, we're in for it. So there would be sporadic firing going on, mm-hmm. and as a PFC, what I do remember is I never saw anybody within the group that I was in getting shot, but I heard stories of the other outposts getting hit and guys getting wounded and winding up in and hospitals. And in my second tour, one of the guys in my outpost that had just landed, a private, just like I was, BFC, that had just landed, was grabbed from behind and tossed up there by a young lieutenant. And as he tossed him out there, the guy got a bullet in his head, right? But he was tossing up there because he had that same fear I had.
He froze.
But the NCO, and he jumped back, but the NCO that I had was, you know, says, you know, we'll get you out there. The lieutenant was, saw him come back like that. He'd been there for a while. He says, get back up there. He said, no, sir. He grabbed him. He tossed him up there. But the moment he tossed him up there, bullets hit the sandbags on top, and one hit him, and he fell dead. So I turned around. This is when I started getting into trouble. I turned around with my rifle and slugged the lieutenant. You see? And then the sergeant looked at me and he says, I didn't see anything. So the lieutenant reports to me, but he's there, but there's no eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. Right. The company commander knows I did it. The first sergeant knows I did it, but nobody would. There were no eyewitnesses to it, and I wouldn't admit to it. You see? And the lieutenant got a broken jaw out of it and taken out. So that's how I started getting into trouble, because the first sergeant started to notice me more. Yeah. Catch this guy, Arcus 15. But yet they couldn't catch me, and I loved that adrenaline. That was my second tour, how I could get away with things and not get caught but come really close. You know, I was getting bored with the Army.
Yeah. Now, during your first tour, yeah, were there any Catooses assigned to your unit?
Oh, yes.
What did you think of them?
Catooses were... I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. Korean augmentation to the United States Army. Right. Catooses were... I had met rock soldiers in Vietnam. I had met rock soldiers when I first landed there, where you go to a search... You go through a escaping invasion course where they slug you with clubs and stuff, trying to disappoint you for ever coming to Korea, before you get assigned to an infantry unit.
This is your first tour?
On my first tour.
That they did this to you?
Right.
Wow.
Right. When you first land, you go through what they call a Korean escape innovation course. And what it basically is, it's the ROC Marine unit, or a ROC Airborne Army unit, mm-hmm, that comes out with clubs and starts beating all the GIs that have landed there, trying to capture them, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get caught by one of them, you get slugged. You get really beat up, because
mm-hmm,
they're all like back belts and stuff like that. And that's part of the... They want to know how good you are at this. The Korean troops are really bad, but they become very good now.
Mm-hmm.
They're really strong units. So, once we went through all of that and got assigned to a unit, stand in formation, they walk up to you, they don't like the way you look, they slug you. Right? Boom, there you go down. You get up, look at them ugly, slug you again.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the formation going back and forth. And this is part of the ROC Army. Now then they have the Catooses that they actually assigned wearing something similar to our uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a lot nicer. They acted like we did. They're like they were Americanized.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't find anything obnoxious about their behavior. In fact, I had made a lot of friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were unit police. And they were the ones that sat with the, you know, at the gate, so they had to bring your pass to go, and we were going to make friends with them, so they'd let us sneak out, mm-hmm, kind of thing. You know, so, and then there were the fights we used to get into with different infantry units in the EM club.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of fun, too, so. The normal GI stuff that you get into.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What else?
Well, from Korea, I guess that's pretty much it. What were the most important things that you took away from your Korean experience when you went to Vietnam? You know, what were the most important lessons you learned? What was the best training you had received?
Well, beginning first with the very short combat experience.
Mm-hmm.
I froze in Korea, but I didn't freeze in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I got that over with there. But I got it over there with an NCO. Yes, he was grouchy, mean, and shit, and all that, but he understood what a private PFC goes through when he first faces combat. I mean, to him, it was like, you know, I understand what you're doing, but don't stay there. You got to move on.
Yeah.
Okay. Crying or not, orders are given, you got to do it. Okay. Next thing was my training. Not only did I have my training from back when I was in the guard, that they taught me a lot about camouflage and all that within the guard, and the use of the M1 Garrett and BARs and all the World War II weapons, but now all the modern weapons, and then my ART2 training for sniper. And I can say something about the airborne, but you've noticed, well, you haven't seen me in uniform, but I don't wear the airborne wings. Okay? I don't wear the airborne wings because they are not, it was not the airborne course out of Fort Benning, Georgia. Right? It was an airborne course in Okinawa. Now, I think it stipulates in the 670-1 that you wear the airborne wings only if you attend Fort Benning, Georgia. So that is the only reason why I don't wear them. But you have to understand something else. And all the training that I was getting to go and preparing for Vietnam, airborne wasn't going to be one that was going to help me at all. So, the discipline-wise, parachute and all that, okay, fine. But you also had the discipline of sniper, you had the discipline in recon, all that. So, that to me was more important. When I got to Vietnam, that training, having already faced some type of combat, was what was the most important to me. Another thing was that I had already been with Orientals and gotten over my fear of Orientals. Yeah. First Oriental girl I go out with, I lost my total fear. You know, and I said, this ain't bad at all. But anyway, the facing the enemy removed the fear that they were only like human beings like the rest of us. No big deal. That was very helpful because I didn't think of the Viet Cong and the MVA like Superman. You know, I just saw them like human beings, no more different. This was not my first tour in the Far East. I had been around Orientals before. I liked their customs, their culture, their belief systems. Went to the temples and all that when I did have time off. And incidentally, going back to that, if you spend 15 days on the DMZ, they give you 5 days off. And in those 5 days, besides chasing women around, I went to the temples, I went down to Seoul, and that's how I got to meet that guy, which is 30 miles south through the mountains to Seoul. Went to the different compounds, visited the different temples, visited the different orphanages, different... I just wanted to know. The kids were so cute when they were little, I'm going like, you know, so when I accidentally ran into this orphanage, I go there and I visit, so I started bringing them stuff, and they're like the cutest little toys you ever saw. You know, Koreans are like so cute when they're little. When they grow up, they turn ugly. You know, the women turn beautiful and the guys turn ugly. No, like Americans, right? But I started wanting to understand their customs, their culture, their language, their food, because I was eating everything, and why they like cat, I have no idea. Their delicacy was eating cat. You know, so learning all that, when I went to Vietnam, it was already set in my mind dealing with Orientals. It was just, this was a different kind and a whole lot smaller, because the Koreans are a lot taller and bigger and huskier. And this guy, I said, how can I consider this guy Superman? I mean, he's a littler than me. And I respected a lot of Koreans that were littler than me, whipped my butt, but I figured, you know, if I dealt with the big guys, I can deal with these guys. Well, I have a lot of respect for the NVA and for the Viet Cong. But basically, I took all this information that I had learned in Korea, and when I landed there, I figured, well, I select the first sergeant to get there, right? And it sort of seemed like, if you want to go, this is your only way out, you've got to have something technical to use, and I'm going to toss an Article 15 on you. But because you're leaving country, you'll get your punishment when you get to Vietnam. Right? And that kind of really was more scary to me. Punishment in Vietnam. They're going to use me as a target practice for the NVA. You know, under orders. I get there. I guess into a replacement company, and all of a sudden I see all these guys in tiger stripes with berets on, so I'm thinking they're special forces or mercenaries. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure because I hadn't seen that in Korea. But they're wearing not the black beret, but a tiger type, different colors. Mm-hmm. You know, not different colors, but camouflaged mm-hmm. colors.
But a beret.
With a beret.
Okay. And this was in what month and year?
That was
67.
Right. That was in October of 67.
October 67.
Right.
Okay. That's when you go to Vietnam. You land at Consulate Air Base.
Right.
Okay. All right. So you got to Vietnam, went to the replacement depot, and how did you go about getting into a Ranger or a LERP unit?
It's on.
Mm-hmm. It's on.
When I arrived in Vietnam and we landed, like I said earlier, I was wearing this overcoat and all this from Vietnam, and I walk up to the door and I walked out and it's like totally humid. And I take this breath and I can't breathe. I'm not acclimated yet, and the airbase got mortar rounds coming in. You know, we saw other guys getting killed as they were coming right out of the airplane. Because the tail of the airplane got hit also. And as we're running across, okay, finally they regrouped us and they took us to a replacement station. When we got to the replacement station, they told us exactly where we're going to sleep, and then they took us to this, looked like a classroom. And we walked in, sat down. And they said, before we begin to assign you to units, how many of you would rather like to go out in the middle of the jungle and find yourself a little hole and go to sleep till your year's up? And then when your year's up, wake up, come back to your unit area, your outpost, and then you leave the country. Yeah, everybody raises their hand. Good, good, good. I like that. Good reception. You know, how many of you like to be out where you don't have your commander on your case, you don't have your officers on your case, you're out there and with this small group of guys and you really enjoy being by yourselves, nobody bothers you, nobody knows where you are, and the enemy doesn't know where you are. And you spend a nice little quiet time, little vacation out here in the tropics, never to be seen by the enemy or even us. How many like that? You know, I'm not raising my hand. Sure, man. Cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm scared stiff. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking twice why I got to Vietnam, why I even decided I wanted to come to Vietnam. It was a totally ugly place. The jungle was beautiful. But it's a totally ugly place, totally hot. And then he says, how many of you like to just not have to listen to anybody whatsoever telling you, giving you orders of any kind, and all you listen is to your squad leader, your team leader, and you can go anywhere you want to, anywhere in the jungle you want to, any place you want to, come Saigon over here to the Thai hotel and have a good time without anybody telling you what to do. Yeah! Okay. All of you that do not want that need to get up and walk out of this building. The rest of you stay that want to. Now I'm going to tell you what it is. Here he goes. It's called LRRP. Very simple little name. No problems, nice units to be with. And he says, nobody bothers you because you don't know, they don't, no one knows that they exist. So you'd be great, great unit. It stands for Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol. When he said reconnaissance, it's recon, you know. He says, how many would like to be in a unit like that? You know, I raised my hand. The rest of the guys start thinking, recon units. And he says, well, the ones that raise their hands stay, the ones that don't want to, step out. So the guys that don't want to be in recon, they get up and walk out. Right. So they just kind of Before, it was a full room, right? Now we got like half of it. The guys are sitting there, the rest have walked out. Okay, so you guys enjoy reconnaissance patrols, right? Yeah. He says, well, these reconnaissance patrols work in 3, 4, 5, and 6-man patrols. How many like that? You know. Cool. I raised up my hand, right? How many don't? The rest of you didn't raise up your hands? Oh, you know. So this is kind of making it smaller and smaller and smaller. Then he says, your mission would be to basically do what your division headquarters wants it done when the enemy is out in the field, and basically wants you to go out there, just find out where they are and come back. Don't get hurt. Don't get into any problems. Come back and tell your division headquarters where they are. How many like that? How many do? Out. You know. So it was like that, to the point there was like maybe 6 or 7 guys left out of, looked like. If I remember correctly, like 30 or 40 of us.
Mm-hmm.
About 6 or 7 stayed there. And he says, so you guys, how many of you guys been in recon? And we all raise our hands and look around. Well, good, good. You're going to like this job. And he starts opening up folders and calling names. Then he finally gets to me with the caller and says, Gomez, Richard, PHC, right? Come over here. He said, go into this room. We're going to talk over here. And that's what he was doing with everyone, talking to individually. We think you should be in this unit because you're an expert rifleman. You got experience in reconnaissance in Korea. You got hunter-killer missions in Korea. The first time I heard hunter-killer, because they never told me in Korea, I thought I was going on a recon mission.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you had hunter-killer missions in Korea. And search and destroy missions. And I go like, well, we blew up 3-story speakers in North Korea. Well, it's a search and destroy. You searched for it, found it, destroyed it. Okay, fine.
How about the hunter-killer? What was he referring to in that context?
And the hunter-killer was looking for the snipers that were firing at us and firing back at them.
Mm.
Right? So he calls that a hunter-killer. Okay. I didn't think anything much of that. Okay. So he says, you belong in this kind of unit, and we decided that since we could put you anywhere in any of these LARP units, and I said, what's a LARP unit? Well, you know, LRP unit. We're going to put you with the 1st Infantry Division, LARPs. And then I was getting up, and another guy walked in, and he said, we're going to put you with the 173rd Airborne. And the guy says, but I'm not airborne. It doesn't matter. You're not going to jump here. Okay, here you go. So anyway, that was basically how I got assigned to it. Then I got my bag with my things that I had brought, you know, my duffel bag, set outside. When I went outside, the LARP that I told you that sat there, well, this guy, Tigers with a tiger beret, sitting there, his name was Perkins. Never forgot, black guy. Tall, lanky guy called Perkins. And I sat next to him and I told him that I was waiting with my bag, and it says, where are you going? And I said, to a LARP unit. Are you sure? You want to go there? And I said, well, I've been recon for a long time. And he goes, you better make damn sure that's where you're going to be. Because when you get there, you're going to get tested. And if you can't survive one patrol, and if you screw up in any way in one patrol, they will kick you to a straight leg outfit. And I said, okay, I can understand that. But then I thought, well, if I go straight left outfit, I'll be in the recon platoon. So no problem. I'll wind up in the recon. So we waited for a while, and they assigned us to a unit. We went directly to the unit. This is what I'll never forget. This was in the morning. Right? By 10 a.m., I'm already there with, in Lycay, with 1st Division LARPs. Right. We go to lunch at 12, or around there, noon. Right. 2 o'clock, they're giving us a briefing. What has been going on, you're a newly assigned guy, the NBA and the VC are not Superman. You're here for the very first time, and you need to get acclimated very quickly. We need to get you involved, blah, blah, blah. This is the 1st Infantry Division. We're going to give you, we do not fail here. No one quits here. You will be tested on your first mission to see if other members of the team will qualify you to see if you stay in this, because this is a totally volunteer outfit. At 6 p.m. that evening, 1800 hours, I'm ready to go on my first mission. I landed the day before. Right? Spend the night replacement. Next morning, right, I'm already assigned by 10 a.m. I'm already going to mission that day, that night. Okay. And went out on the mission. They handed me my Tigers, this is your gear. I didn't know nothing about the patch, had no patch. And then I asked them, and I said, when I came back from the patrol, and they said, shaking, because it was like, after I came back, because you have to be so quiet out there, you have to be so quiet that you have to control your breathing, you have to control your coughing, your sneezing, releasing of air, everything. You have to mentally control this, and it's pitch black dark at night. And I'm being tested at the same time to see if I'm worth this. Now, I already had what they call reconnaissance discipline, which means not making a sound through the woods, knowing how to sneak up on the enemy, knowing all these things. Plus, they had made me the RTO, the radio operator. Okay. Because that's what they do with all the new guys. Hand them the radio. I already knew how to do that. So, I come back, and they accept me in the team. I'm accepted. They told me that the day after, we come back the next day, come in at daylight, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, they said, yeah, we accept you. I come to realize they sent me on a mission like that just to test me out. It wasn't very far out. Maybe, if I can remember correctly, maybe about 10 clicks out to the jungle. Sit out there all night long on an ambush, and then come back. Early morning. See how I operate at nighttime, how I behave, if I talked, if I went to sleep and all that. And they had a guy right behind me not saying a word to me to see if I closed, if I acted like I nodded or whatever. So then went to sleep. That sort of thing. So I came back in, they say, okay, we're gonna keep you in this unit, and I said, when do I get, I know that you got an alert patch out here in the unit thing. And I said, when do I get that? And he says, well, you get it, but you don't put it on your uniform because you have nothing on your uniform. And I said, fine. Well, so what do I have to do for that? And he said, you got to pull so many missions to be able to get the patch. You can't just don't get the patch when you walk in here and then quit tomorrow. Call yourself alert.
Yeah.
So then, when the issuing of the beret came up, and they said, we're going to issue you guys berets. Nothing is authorized. They said, we're going to issue you this beret, this black beret. You need to put 20 missions, and you got to make contact in those 20 missions. And, what else happened? Then the interesting thing about this was the amount of missions you have to pull to earn the beret. But then the next day, we come in, and that night we go back out, this time for a 3-day mission. And it kept going like that all the way through until the Tet Offensive began in January, February of 68. And it was just consistent mission after mission after mission.
What kind of training did they give you when you first arrived in the unit? Anything?
They looked at my background and they didn't give me any training but an orientation course. The orientation course where they told me the VA and the the VC and the NVA were not Superman. That's the thing. Welcome to, like, case of Vietnam. You're in the first division. Burps, this is our mission. This is what you're going to do. This is the team you belong to. These are your team members. Blah, 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 like that. And they looked at my background and they said, well, you got this training in Okinawa for ART-2 sniper training. You got the academy training that you received in reconnaissance in with 2nd Infantry Division and all that. So you're ready to go on your missions. You don't need any training. Right. All of you that have been coming straight from the States that have not received anything, that come straight from AIT in here, and because they were good shots and all that, they get assigned directly to, for whatever reason, they get assigned directly to our LERP unit, we'll go to Recondo School and we will pick you and let you know if you survive long enough and you're still here and you decide to one, you decide to stay with the unit. Two, as a volunteer. Two, the unit decides to keep you. Okay. Three, you are not killed. Four, we are given a slot to send so many people to Recondo School, we will send you to Recondo School. So it was all these things. Okay. And because I had all this training, they said, well, we don't need to send you to Recondo School, we need to send those guys coming straight from the States. You already have this experience. So I didn't go to Recondo School. And they sent me directly into the field immediately. So from that day on, I started going out. They asked me if I had already been in a firefight. I said yes. And my records showed, and we should get a hold of those records. The records that show that I have ART-2 training, the ones this guy was looking at. Okay. There, because it showed all the training that I had received in the Far East. And the what I received in Okinawa, what I had done in 2nd Infantry Division in Korea, and then so that the reason why they didn't need to send me to train and they put me directly into the mission. And then my team members, which at that time was Wallach, Mike Weiss, Fouts, Thomas Fouts, Robert Samuel Turner, and me, were members of Team 9. We're constantly going out on missions. Each one of them had received some kind of training prior to becoming LERPs that they didn't need to be sent to Recondo School, as far as I can remember, because I don't remember missing those guys at any one time because they were in training, but I do remember us being taken out of the team to go do sniping for the 1st Battalion, 2nd Infantry of the first of the Big Red One, the Black Scarves, they call them, and for the 2nd of the 2nd, and for the 1st of the 16th, the 1st of the 28th, taking us out of the, taking me out of my LERP unit to go snipe for them when they were receiving sniper fire and they didn't have snipers or anyone trained in sniper-like training. I didn't go to sniper school in the United States. The official school, it was what I was trained from the 1st Special Forces Group in Okinawa. So that too was sniper-like training. And they were using me for that. So in that part, all through the time that I was there, I was receiving, I was going directly and pulling what I call, I don't know what the military calls them, but there were monitor missions, which is missions where we monitored the enemy and followed it for 2 or 3 days without being seen. And we had hunter-killer missions. Our hunter-killer mission was, in Vietnam, was, as a LERP, was you go out, and anything you run into, you hunt it down and kill it. Anything, anyone, anything. Search and destroy missions, while you're searching for a for the enemy and destroy it, which is similar to the hunter and killer, but on the search and destroy, you're basically operating slightly different than the hunter-killer. Hunter-killer was just outright take no prisoners, kill everybody. Mm-hmm. That's from my recollection. And then it was, what was the other one? I have this thing's written down at home.
Did you guys do snatch missions?
Yes, prisoner snatch.
Mm-hmm.
We also snatched officers from mm-hmm. from BC or NBA units mm-hmm. that we knew was in the area. And what was the other one? Stay behinds, mm-hmm. the last stay behinds. An infantry unit would leave and would stay behind for the gooks to come out, and we take care of them. And then the other one was hot LCs.
Mm-hmm.
They usually would drop us in as a forward element for the infantry before they got there.
Okay.
So we would recon the area and make sure that it was safe, and it would not be a hot LC when they would land,
mm-hmm.
when their eagle flights would come in. So we did those short range missions,
mm-hmm.
and then the long range missions where we went deep in behind enemy lines, where we had no artillery and no air cover. So we had to use our M79 man, our grenadier as our own artillery,
mm-hmm.
and our own weapons to get us out. So that depended on all the guys having very strong legs to run a lot and carry all the weapons, all the ammunition that we need to carry for the mission.
And how long would the long range missions usually last?
3 days to 7 days.
How much you'd have to carry your ammunition, your weapons, water? How much would your packs usually weigh for a 3 to 7 day mission?
Well, if I can give you an outline how much I carried, personally. I carried an M79. So for a mission like that, I would carry 125 HEs for my M79. Plus, if I carried my ART-2 M14, plus magazines, maybe 18 to 25 magazines, with duplex rounds, you know. And all these are in Claymore bags
mm-hmm.
that are strapped on you. And my canteens of water would, because I didn't want them dangling and making noise, I put them all in a Claymore bag. Everything that I was using, because I love Claymore bags. I had all the HEs, but I didn't have them on this vest that I was carrying
mm-hmm.
HEs on, because they go into little snap things that snapped, and I didn't like to snap the noise
mm-hmm.
maker. But I carried them in Claymore bags, stacked one on top of each other, nice and tight,
mm-hmm.
and closed them. And I carried 125 of those. Then my three canteens plus my canteen bag, because I didn't like the idea of putting tape on my grenades. I put all the grenades with the pin facing up in a canteen cover and stick them in there, so that every time I would put my hand in there, I would be able to get the grenade without pulling the pin
mm-hmm.
and taking it out. And I had I could put eight fragmentation grenades in a canteen cover and then close it and carry that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another Claymore bag where I had it full of white phosphorus, which you call Willie Peters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I carried a .38 on my chest that, over my heart, that I stole from chopper pilots, because I didn't like the .45. And I had a United States Air Force survival mat that I stole from the Air Force. And you notice I didn't buy anything. So the weight of all of that, and then they will look at you and go like, I don't think you're carrying up. Carry this Claymores besides, so you throw this Claymores on you. Then you jump up and down to make sure you make no noise. And we also wore a rope as a belt
mm-hmm.
instead of a belt.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things that they tell you when you first go into combat, you change by the time you get into combat. And the reasons why they tell you to stick your pants in your boots
becomes very apparent when you're out there, because you get things crawling up your legs, you know. And you close your shirt completely tight up here, and you wear warm, long sleeves. And it's over 100 degrees with 100% humidity, 120 degrees. Mm-hmm. Plus, you got all this gear on you. Plus, you got all this camouflage. Obviously, you get completely camouflaged, even into your shirt in case it opens up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got the bullets that you need for your 38. And I carried two 38s. Then I had one strapped down here, and I had one on my chest, like I told you. And if I didn't have it on my chest, I had it down here. Because I always figured, like, if they shoot at me, they're going to hit this thing first.
Mm-hmm.
But since I carried so much HE, high explosive, I figured I would go off like a 4th of July if they hit one of those HEs anyway.
Right.
So I figured I'm not going to feel a thing when this thing goes off. I'll be sitting in the moon. So a lot of the guys would look at me that I was carrying, trying to like move away. But they had as much gear to carry, which mostly was ammo.
Yep.
And then you got a claymore bag full of food.
Mm-hmm.
But since we didn't have time a lot of times to eat, you carry very little of that. And you threw nothing. It didn't throw a single thing. We were the best environmentalists you could find. We cut nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We snuck through areas. Instead of cutting bamboo like the infantry does, we snuck through the area, and if we ate, we put everything back in the bag. Didn't dispose of anything. No evidence of anything ever left behind,
mm-hmm.
that we were there. And of course, one of the things they told us, we had no tattoos in our bodies,
mm-hmm.
no evidence that we were Americans. The uniform had nothing on it that said we were Americans. So that way they couldn't say that. The U.S. Army couldn't say, well, in this particular kind of war that we belong to. Because LERPs, later on I found out, basically LERPs back then did not exist,
mm-hmm.
say, officially.
When you were out on patrols, you'd know beforehand whether you were going to be tracking or trying to locate VC versus North Vietnamese units?
We would know whether we're going out to become a listening post, stop someplace,
mm-hmm.
to listen whether someone was would be coming by that area.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we were going to go out to set up some type of ambush, like an L ambush or like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because our team leader would tell us and say, well, look, I went to the briefing, this is what they told me we need to do, and we need to go to this area and do this. And we go and we do it. So we basically had an idea what we were going to do for the amount of ammunition we were carrying. But they always told us we were going out overnight, and I still carried ammunition for 7 days.
Okay.
I was not going to be left without ammo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since I had gotten used to the weight, I said, the heck with it. I don't plan to bring all this back with me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And when you went out and you came up against those different types of units, whether it be a Viet Cong unit or having a North Vietnamese unit, what were the biggest differences between the two?
The NVA were organized like an army. They had uniforms. They acted with... They used tactical maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
From what I remember being on the PFC. The VC dressed, sure they say, okay, VC wear black pajamas and all that, but not all of them did.
Mm-hmm.
They dressed like civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they, what I noticed from them was they basically behaved in hit and run. They'd hit you,
mm-hmm.
they'd take off. And they don't leave anybody back. Somebody got wounded, got killed like this, they try not to leave anybody, but it counts. But if you kill them all, obviously they're going to be bodies, but otherwise they try to take. And also they try to have so much stealth that they'll hit you and you won't see them. So that's where the LERPs are very good at that, because, for one, the LERPs wouldn't allow themselves to be seen, so they usually would walk up on them. so we would ambush them first,
mm-hmm.
before they would ambush us.
Okay.
So we were turning the tables on them. The MVA, in turn, operated like an infantry unit.
Mm-hmm.
So they were organized, they were disciplined, they were heavily armed, and they obviously had so much better weapons than the VC.
So if you were out, if you came across a Viet Cong unit or a Viet Cong patrol,
mm-hmm.
you would likely engage it. But if you came up against a PAVN unit, larger, better weapons, better firepower, you would try to avoid it?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
If there was a large VC unit.
Okay.
Okay. And we were in a hunter-killer mission, per se.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We would automatically, obviously, wanting to stay alive, right. and we're only five of us, or four of us, or six of us.
Mm-hmm.
We would take count of their weapons, how many VC there are, and all that, and report that back.
Mm-hmm.
If we thought, and our team leader thought at the time, that we could become their mosquito. Meaning that we can start doing hit and run on them, hit and run like a mosquito bothering you and you mm-hmm. can't find the sucker.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So we keep, or we wait till it gets dark, or if it's dark already and they're walking by, then we start taking the last man out, mm-hmm. the last man on the line, then the next man, as quietly as possible to cause some type of damage to the unit. But outright broad daylight, never.
Hmm.
Never.
No.
We automatically would turn into a reconnaissance unit and start figuring out their supplies,
mm-hmm.
their equipment,
mm-hmm.
their manpower,
yeah.
equipment.
Just collecting intelligence that you would take back to headquarters.
Right.
Okay.
And because we're a hunter-killer, thinking of ways on how we might be able to hit them.
Mm-hmm.
and or follow them. If that's our mission, to go and hunt that unit down, and we know this NBA unit and finally run into it,
mm-hmm.
then our mission would be one, monitor mission, follow it. Two, get reconnaissance information on them.
Mm-hmm.
Three, hunter killer, hit it at nighttime when it goes to sleep.
Yeah.
Because they'll put sentries out and harass it,
mm-hmm.
harass the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we survive, because the larger unit, 150, 200, 300 guys, then we come back and tell them what kind of damage we did,
mm-hmm.
what we think we did, and then give them the intelligence report on what we ran into. And half of the time when we come back, G2, intelligence, wouldn't believe us. We ran into this regimental unit. How come you're still alive? Because they don't go out on missions.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't understand the capacity
mm-hmm.
of what we were going through out there. So half of the time they didn't believe us until that same unit would attack a large infantry unit
mm-hmm.
and destroy the hell out of it, because they never told the infantry, that infantry commander, that that unit was out there. And in other words, they were not using the intelligence correctly, because for one, they didn't believe that it was out there. You see? So we had those problems. Not to mention that if the infantry fired on it and killed someone that the official brass did not agree was an enemy soldier, that soldier goes to jail. You see, so it was that type of insanity
mm-hmm.
going on. And what else?
Well, what about operations against Viet Cong infrastructure? You know, what became in 67, 68, and after the Phoenix program for the civilian side of it, for CORDS. Were there ever any operations where you guys would be your target would not necessarily be a military unit, but a corrupt province chief, a province chief that was suspected of being Viet Cong or North Vietnamese sympathizer.
They didn't send, I don't remember my team ever being sent that as a team, mm-hmm. but we would have like a day or two break, and then they would call me in and they would go, you got ART2 training on this, we got you this observer, he comes from the area where you're going, he will be your observer. And who is he? Mm-hmm. Could be a South Vietnamese, could be an infantry recon specialist from a reconnaissance, a recon guy from the infantry unit in the area. Mm-hmm. Where this village is at, or their outpost is right outside the village, and this guy has gone on patrols into the area, could it be an officer, goes into patrols in the area and recognizes the guy and says, when you go over there, shoot him. Right? Mm-hmm. Your job is to take out that sympathizer. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would go with the guy. The guy is looking, he's at my observer, he says, I found him, I'm looking through my scope. And I check with his, make sure, yeah, that's the guy, boom. Mm-hmm. One shot, one kill. Unless the guy would go, but we got to take back evidence that we killed him. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, shoot. He's in the village. How are we going to get in the village? He says, well, we'll wait. They're going to pick the body, take it over here like this. We'll go over there. Well, take his papers. It depended. Sometimes they take his papers, sometimes they told us to take his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
To show,
yeah.
Especially the South Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
to show that the job was actually done.
Yeah.
It's in a bag, here it is. Gross
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many missions like that were you involved with? Do you recall?
They started in Korea, where I went on a mission. From Okinawa, I went on what they call a practice mission to Burma.
Mm-hmm.
For ART2 training after I had finished. And I thought it was practice, but I think, thinking back, I think we actually shot these guys. Right? But they said, this is going to be your run to see if you can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have some special forces guys going with you to see that you do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was more like, I was going on this and the special forces guys were sort of like, if I don't shoot them, they will.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So I went on one assignment like that, which I thought was part of my training assignment out of Okinawa, and then the rest were in Vietnam.
Okay.
And I,
how many
think
in Vietnam?
Was I went to first they sent me to several battalion headquarters. Like they sent me to the battalion of the 1st and 2nd. And I went out with some of the companies
mm-hmm.
that were being sniped. And they obviously didn't have any snipers,
yep.
so they sent me out and as a counter sniper.
Yep.
There was a sniper out there sniping on the company constantly.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to take out the sniper.
No, I mean like what you described, going in, a Viet Cong sympathizer, you know, a province chief or political... someone who's active in village politics that's influencing the village and making them pro-VC or pro-NDA.
I don't remember exactly how many of those. There's only been two other people I've told this, but I'll put it down here.
Mm-hmm.
It was 120 that I shot.
Okay.
Okay. Out of those were other snipers,
mm-hmm.
provincial chiefs, sympathizers, anyone which they would tell me and say, take this guy out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Say was one of those. This is war.
Mm-hmm.
Say goodbye. Right? And but it was a total of 120.
Okay.
That I did.
And it included in that all those.
That was included in the sniping.
Yeah.
Of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't remember because I lost count for what reasons I was shooting them.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
And what they were, I just saw the target. Said, yeah, that's the one.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want the bullet? Between the eyes, on the nose, and you tell me. And it's kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
You like the Nintendo bunch nowadays? you know, they go out and they shoot,
mm-hmm.
and it looks more like a game than it did, you know, and it would seem to me like that.
Hmm.
You know, but even though it was gross, I never thought of it. I said, I am a warrior and I am in combat.
Mm-hmm.
I will not look at this and I will not take it personal. These guys are in war, you know, Sin Loy, too bad, right? They should have never been doing that because they were going to send a guy like me to shoot your ass.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's over with. And that has helped me a lot because I don't sit back and think about all those people I've killed.
Yeah.
It was a combat situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I plan to bring myself back if I have to shoot everybody. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, what was your first operation where you actually had to engage the enemy in Vietnam? And what kind of unit was it? What was the mission? Your first actual military contest with the Vietnamese enemy?
On a reconnaissance mission. We went out on a reconnaissance mission. I don't know exactly who exactly we were. Reconning.
They're moving down now.
I'm going to go to the phone.
Okay, I'll pause it.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead and continue, please.
We went on patrol like we usually do in the evening, a night patrol. And this one was, where was it? Was about two or three clicks from the base that we were operating from. And we were just going to set up ambush, mission, nothing, anything, just to see if anybody was in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran into, seemed like, from what we could tell, from what my team leader later told us, there was about 50 Viet Cong. And the way we got to spot them is that they got really low. They were coming down a trail, and they got really low, and we got really low, and we could spot the dark figures like that. So we decided, we were here and they were there like this, we decided to open up on them. And that was my first action, my first firefight with them, where we hit them, flanked them, kept firing at them. Then we received this hail of bullets from them, and we all, the team, really decided to get the hell out of there. Right? We weren't very far from our camp that they could call in artillery.
Mm.
So we pulled out of the area, and they called in artillery on them. But that was because we were like two or three clicks from Lake K, just in the outskirts of the division headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
So in other situations, we didn't have the luxury of artillery or air support.
Mm-hmm.
But this was close by. It was an easy mission,
mm-hmm.
nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we ran into this 50 guys, and I think it was in their preparation before they set up the tit offensive of the 68.
So did you ever determine or know if they were VC or PAVN?
No. They sent an infantry unit out of the red lines of the 1st and 28th to check it out the next day.
Mm-hmm.
If there were any bodies and all that. Of course, they didn't find anything. But they found blood everywhere.
They found blood but no bodies?
No bodies, right.
Yeah.
They usually would always take their bodies with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one was hurt from your team?
No.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. No, I could. They, in other missions, they got wounded, things like that. I got wounded, but not in this particular mission.
And what happened with your unit, and what happened in Lac Cay during Tet of 68? And what did you guys find yourselves doing during that very...
We found ourselves doing almost everything. We were doing short-range operations to do reconnaissance around the division headquarters. We were going out and supporting battalions. We were also going out and supporting, going on long range missions into the Iron Triangle looking for large regimental units, mm-hmm. NVA regimental units that intelligence had heard was in the area but they didn't know exactly where.
Okay.
They would send us out to Song Bay and go across into the Cambodian area, to Parrot's Peak and cross there into the Cambodian area. the I think of the wrong set zone, mm-hmm. and Michelin Plantation and areas like that. I can't remember the names of the places, but...
But you would actually go ahead and conduct operations into Cambodia, into Laos.
Conduct an operation that we were looking for mm-hmm. a particular unit, or to find out whether they were massing and assembling in Cambodia and then coming across. Mm-hmm. For G2 intelligence, which then send it out maybe to the CIA or send it out to the Air Force, to bomb it, or mm-hmm. whoever was organizing any unofficial unit to go to across, because we weren't supposed to. You see, but since we didn't exist anyway,
right?
You know, they would use us for some of it. But that was kind of far out, because I found out in one of the stories that somebody else wrote, Nick Staten, I think, said that the 1st Infantry Division was the only division that caught, that was not surprised by the 1968 Tet Offensives, because their alerts and their infantry recon caught the NVA and the VA units by surprise, by their method of patrol, that they constantly kept patrolling the area, mm-hmm. going deeper and deeper and deeper and searching around. And then next thing during the Tet Offensive was that Tongsonup was completely surrounded by NVA and Viet Cong, and they sent us in to see how we could help the unit, and we came in from behind and cut through, shooting the enemy from behind, until we penetrated in and got into the Tongsonup Air Force Base. And the item there with security patrols of the Air Force to help protect it. And once we had cut in, we turned right around and started firing at the enemy. And I say that because here in the Guard now, I ran into this guy. And he was telling the story about this guy that he ran into that was with the Ranger unit, mm-hmm. helping to protect his Air Force base. And he was one of the sergeants of security police. And Varela, mm-hmm. right? And he was talking about that he ran into this guy, he didn't know, he didn't remember his name, like Game or something like that. And I'm standing right behind, and he's telling the story. Mm-hmm. And he says, and they cut through the enemy, and they were coming straight at us, but we had heard that there was some type of Ranger type unit that was going to be cutting through the enemy. So not to shoot them, they were wearing Tigers. But we couldn't tell, it was pitch black. So I don't know, we shot some of them, you know, but because they were firing at everything. And that was one of the problems we always ran into, is that our own people always trying to kill us. Mm-hmm. And we broke through, got in there, and he was standing up, he was an NCO, and he was telling his security people, and he stood up, and I jumped in, and I grabbed him and pulled him down. And he says, yeah, this guy grabbed me and pulled me down, and I think his name... Because later on, after the firefight was over, we talked. Mm. Right? And he's telling the story right there at the guard unit, and it happens to belong to the same guard unit that I was with. And I said, yeah, and he jumped in the hole where you were, right? And then you stood up. Yeah, when I stood up, he pulled me down. Yeah, he pulled you down, right? Then he told you, are you stupid or something? Yeah. And yeah, he told me that, and then he keeps telling the story and all that kind of thing. And then he turns around and says, how do you know? And he looks at my name and he goes, it was you!
Mm-hmm. Small world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he lives in San Antonio.
Wow.
You know, and he retires a chief master. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they call a command sergeant major in the Air Force, but I think he's a chief master sergeant. Sergeant chief master. Something. Mm-hmm. Whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Command sergeant major. He retired from the Air Force. And he was telling his story when he was in Vietnam and Tongsonup got invaded. And it was an invasion because they completely surrounded it. And they had sent us because they wanted us to slow down the attack to protect the airplanes and support the security police in protecting the aircraft. Mm-hmm. And that's what we had done. And it was five teams from First Infantry Division, the other teams were from the 9th, the other team was from the 25th. So that's how, that's when I found out that there were other LERPs in other divisions.
Yeah.
My focus at the time was only with that division. With my division, I was not thinking who had LERPs and other units.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought, as a matter of fact, I was so egotistical, I thought we were the only ones. You know,
mm-hmm.
that our division was the only one that had tough ass crazy guys like us. Until then, because then I started seeing LERPs everywhere, and I used to look at my guys and go, those are not ours, eh? They look exactly like us. And they just happened to belong to other units.
Yeah.